Welcome to Motopod, the internet radio show all about motorcycle road racing. This is episode number 627, the MotoGP season in review. I'm Jim McDowell. I'm here to guide you through all the ins and outs of the season, but to help me along the way is my good friend Joel. Say hello, Joel.
Hi, everybody.
So, it's that time of year. Season's done in review, but first I'd like to thank everyone who's donated over the holiday season, and I hope everyone has had a great holiday. But in particular, I'd like to thank Keith Kobach, Nick Saban, Scott Saunter, Alan Fleming, and Joshua Tattell. If you can help out with the show by donating, that would be greatly appreciated. You can do as little as $2 a month. You can go to our website, www.motopodcast.com. On the left side, there's a donate button, or you can go to www.patreon.com/motopod. Every little bit helps, and it helps like in ways that you can't even possibly imagine. So let's get on to some news, Joel. Things that have been happening in the racing world since last we hit the kill button on the old L motorcycles. So first thing I want to do is I want to give a shout out to Ken Roczen. He won a 450 Supercross main event in St. Louis, which is an amazing feat in my opinion, because Roczen went through two very serious injuries. He almost lost his, lost his left arm in a severe crash that he had. Had very little movement in that. Came back to race after that. Had another injury on his opposite arm where he got stuck in the spinning wheel of another, I think, of Justin Barsha's motorcycle. And now he had last year had trouble competing because he had was later found out to be diagnosed with Epstein-Barr, which is a disease that creates you to be tired, or causes you to be tired, I guess is a better way to say that. So for him to come back from all of that and actually win a Supercross event's pretty amazing. So little shout out from Motopod to Ken Roczen. A second shout out, well, it's Supercross season, or it's actually Dakar season, and I love Dakar. You know, Skylar and I, we've talked about that a lot. But Ricky Brabac, the American in the motorcycle class, is actually leading the Dakar rally, and he has got a 20-minute lead heading into the rest day, because that's as far as I know that they are right now. I think they might be a couple stages after the rest day, but hopefully Ricky Brabac can bring it home, become the first American to ever win at Dakar. However, Dakar has once again reared its ugly head of tragedy with the loss of Paulo Gonzalez, who was in the bikes class with Ricky Brabac. He was tragically succumbed to injuries sustained in a crash on one of the special stages the day after, after the rest day in there. So that's some happenings going on in the motorcycling world, some racing that's going on. But let's talk about a little bit of news that we got coming from MotoGP. When last we left, we were in Valencia. We found out that Jorge Lorenzo was going to retire after a brilliant career, and that left the second HRC seat open. Rumors abound about who was going to get that seat. Some said Cal Crutchlow. Some said Johann Zarco. Some said Alex Marquez. The dust is all settled, and it's Alex Marquez. What do you think about that, Joel?
Well, you know, it's a little bit surprising. I think, you know, Alex had a wonderful 2019 campaign, and I, you know, winning the championship was incredible. And I thought I could see Johan on the seat, Cal maybe in second, and then maybe looking at Alex in third. So to me, I think it's a bit of a surprise.
Really? You think it's that big of a surprise? This is a kid who is the defending Moto2 champion, and has done what many other Moto2 champions have done, and moved on to the MotoGP class. So it's shocking to you?
Yeah, I mean, to me, I think when I look at Alex, I think I see a guy that who's had a great 2019 campaign, but before that, it's been hit or miss. You know, unlike his brother, granted, his brother is an icon, and he's arrived and he's won multiple world championships and on the big class. But I think, to me, I feel like Alex, to some extent, maybe hasn't seasoned enough.
He's been in the class for 5 years. How much more seasoning do you want to put on this kid?
Yeah, well, and that's where I get back to that. It's kind of a hit or miss on this. That's where I think Johan, I thought with his age and with his ability on the bike so far, I just felt like he was the favorite in that group.
You know, I'll look at it this way. I do think that it is a bit of a surprise that he has been selected to be there with his brother. But in reality, I got to stop and think for a second and go, who else did HRC have as a possibility to put on the motorcycle? Jorge left them in a lurch. He had a 2-year contract. Yes, Jorge had a very bad crash, and he chose to walk away from the sport. That's fine. I have no problems with that whatsoever. But everybody else already had a contract in place to ride somewhere. So who were you going to go get? You had to go look in the Moto2 class to find someone to ride. Basically, I don't think anybody wanted Zarco. And I say that only in the fact that Zarco had so much trouble when he jumped ship and was trying to ride the KTM, which, in all honesty, the KTM is very similar in layout, 90-degree V4 to what the Honda is. Now, Zarco did show well on the races that he did run for Honda at the end of the year, but it wasn't earth-shattering, and he didn't set the world on fire, and he was on a 2018 chassis, which even Crutchlow admits has better front-end feel. So I see where Honda's going that way, but the question looms, did Mark himself say, look, you need to go get my brother because, well, my brother's always been better than me? That's the question I have.
It's a great question. And you know, maybe the word I was looking for maybe was more not season, but consistency.
Now we're there where I want to go.
Yeah, and I think that's maybe where I was missing the boat for a second there. I think the consistency, I didn't see it until 2019. And so, no question, he's a talent. It's going to be an interesting dynamic. Two brothers on the same team. Incredible.
Well,
an incredible year.
You know, for the consistency part of it, I think Alex was more consistent than anybody else in the Moto2 class. And I mean, we'll go into that when we do Moto2 review. But if you are handed an opportunity to ride on a factory MotoGP bike, you are not going to turn that down. There is a limited number of those seats. There's 24 of them, right? It's like asking a guy who's in F2 if he wants to drive your Formula One car next year. There's nobody who's going to say no to that, because anyone who's racing cars wants to try to get to the pinnacle of F1. Just like anybody who's riding Moto3 or Moto2, everybody wants to get to the pinnacle that is MotoGP. So you might as well go take that moment and go do that. Now, can he really do it? Well, let's look at it this way. If anybody was going to be given all the information and all the secrets to unlocking how to ride that Honda motorcycle absolutely at the ragged edge, really only Mark would only really ever tell Alex, because he is his brother. So he's in good hands from that point, that he's going to be able to get all the information, and he's going to be able to say, hey, how are you doing this? And Mark's going to look at him and tell him, well, this is how I do it. Now, the question is then, is Alex going to be able to do what Mark tells him to do, and will it work for him? Because they are slightly different builds or slightly different heights. That means the weight's going to be in a slightly different place on the motorcycle. Granted, it's a small difference, but sometimes small differences are everything that it takes to win in a class. With that, I think they made the right choice.
It's going to be interesting. I'll tell you, the dynamic there, I think overall, when you look at those two guys in 2020, Mark's proven he can ride the Honda. It's going to be interesting to see how Alex transitions onto the big bike.
Yeah, it's going to be one of those this is a stay tuned moment. We have no idea how it's going to go, but somehow, some way, this is going to be fun to watch, and it's going to be just as much fun to watch this as it was to watch the impending Jorge Lorenzo, Mark Marquez battle for Honda supremacy. Well, I guarantee you, Alex isn't going to be the superior one in that camp, but the question is he going to be in the top five consistently? We don't know. So it's a stay put. So Zarco was mentioned for the ride, but Zarco didn't wind up with the ride. But where did Zarco go? Well, he went to Aventia Ducati, who basically shunned Carol Abraham. And now Zarco is going to be riding on a Ducati. Does the Frenchman go better on the Ducati than he did on the KTM? Yes or no?
I'd say yes.
You think he's going to be better on the Ducati than he was on the KTM?
I do. I think I guess it's too early to say. I would say yes. I think that, but again, it's going to come back to results. I think once we start to see those guys go out and do their normal laps and times and so forth, it'll be interesting to see what the results are. But I feel like he's, and maybe I'm just in left field here on this one here, but I feel like he's got that ability to do that.
Well, I look at it as it couldn't be any worse than it was at KTM. So I'll give you the benefit. I mean, that was hideous, yes. Right? I mean, Zarco literally did not want to ride that motorcycle. And you know what? Here's the thing. Pit Buyer said it, and he said, hey, it takes the best motorcycles are the motorcycles that are not the best bikes. You need a sort of rough around the edges kind of bike. And yeah, if you look at the Honda, it is rough around the edges. It's a difficult bike to master. It's not a Yamaha that's a very corner speedy motorcycle. It's not a Suzuki, which again is a corner speed kind of motorcycle. But it's more in that Honda frame, more like a Ducati kind of thing. But the team was definitely, you know, there's a lot to be said there of a team dynamic. Was Zarco getting the support that he felt like he needed? Or was Pit Buyer looking at Zarco saying, well, just get on the thing and ride it? And if you read sort of, if you sit back and you think about it, and you kind of see it, sort of read it between the lines, you kind of get that maybe KTM wasn't giving Zarco sort of the love that he wanted and he needed. And I think Zarco is a rider that needs to feel like he's loved. Like, he needs to be in a team that's going to wrap his arms around him and say, that's okay, it's all good, we're fine here. And does he get it at Aventia? It's definitely one of the smaller teams. It's definitely got, in my mind, a little more home-y flavor. But it is a Ducati still. And Aventia is going to get some really good bikes because they have Zarco. So Ducati themselves may see Zarco as a person who can ride their motorcycle. So it's a stay tuned for me. I just don't know what's going to happen.
Well, and the other thing too, the outlier there too, his recovery from his ankle injury too. So it's,
yes, that is another wild card that we have to think about. I didn't think about that, but yes, how's the ankle? We don't know yet.
Yeah, he says it's good, it's recovering well, but you know what? Who knows until he's actually on the bike, pushing the limit, so to speak.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, we're just not going to know. Again, something I just want to stay sort of on top of. I want to see how testing goes. I think we're like 35 days away from Sepang, so that's going to be interesting to go with there. So let's move on to the last bit of news that I got here. yet again, the Iannone is in trouble with the FIM and in trouble with everyone in general. I mean, so this round is that Iannone was submitted a drug test, I think, I want to say like after Australia, or maybe, oh no, sorry, it was after the Sepang round in Malaysia, and basically he submitted his samples as is required. The samples were then checked by the FIM, and the FIM found, as far as we know, trace amounts of an anabolic steroid, which is a banned substance according to the rules. They found it in his A sample. So they said, yeah, you are now on provisional probation pending the results of provisional disqualification or exemption from racing, essentially, next year. But you do have the right to appeal and have your B sample tested. Of course, Iannone did. The B sample came back, are you ready for this? Positive as well for the anabolic steroid, but again, in trace amounts. Now, his lawyer is now arguing that because they were in Thailand and Japan and Malaysia, that they could have, he could have eaten tainted food that would cause the same effect as this anabolic steroid. This is just a classic Iannone story. I think it's just like, okay, we ate bad food and now we have an anabolic steroid in our system. I'm not sure how that happens, but I'm not a chemist, nor am I a doctor. But I don't mean to laugh at Iannone, man. I don't want to be in his shoes. But what do you make of all of this?
Yeah, well, first of all, it's got to be extremely embarrassing for him and for his team to have to walk this tightrope, so to speak. And I mean, he's always denied it, though. He's always denied doping. And so you start to think, okay, but the tests, on the other hand, are saying just the opposite. And so at the end of the day, the proof's in the pudding. I mean, literally, you look at what's available, what's going on, and the tests have come back. Steroids are in the test samples. Although I got to tell you, his attorney's pretty shrewd, and to be able to articulate and maybe argue that it could have come from food contamination. So it's going to be an interesting dynamic playing out.
Yeah, you know, here's the thing: it leaves Aprilia in a lurch, is what it does, because they've now appealed to the FIM court, who essentially can take a couple of months to decide what they want to do about this. In the meantime, he is banned. He is banned from MotoGP. So here's Aprilia, who now have built a new bike. They're the only people who really have a brand new motorcycle for the season. They have Aleix to test with, but they don't have Iannone to test as well. Now, what do you do if you're them? Well, this isn't going to be decided in the 30-odd days that we have until we're testing in Sepang. So you're going to have to put somebody else on the bike, and it's believed that the shunned Carl Abraham from Aventia Ducati will go over and will ride on the Aprilia. So again, I hate to say, I sound like a broken record on this so far, but it's another one of these. We got to wait and see. We got to see where this is going to come, where this is going to go, how this is going to be looked at in the FIM Court of Appeals. And they have a really distinct thing that they're trying to make sure that they're doing the right thing with this doping. And I think Iannone's a partier, but I don't think he would be in that anabolic steroid thing. But who's to know? Who's to say? You know, sometimes that drive competitiveness thing will overshadow sound judgment. And potentially, maybe that's where it is. We all have made missteps in our lives and whatnot. So let's just leave this one in the courts and just let it sit and see what we can do or can't do and have it all work from that point. So I think that covers the news, unless you got some more with that one.
Well, just one little piece to that, too. I think the scary part, too, is if you think about it, if he's banned, that's from all competition, what, for 3-4 years?
Yeah. Can't race a motorcycle for 3 or 4 years.
So we're talking about a guy who's already, he's not terribly young.
No, but him and his brother have set up a management group, and they're managing some Moto2 riders. They're going to manage Fanati. So I mean, he is looking at life after MotoGP, but I don't think he wants to start a life after MotoGP right now.
Yeah, absolutely. I agree.
All right. That's everything I've got for news and whatnot. So let's roll into the season in review. And I think let's just start with the Moto3 season. Again, Moto3 is some of the best racing that's actually in the championship. It's usually incredibly unpredictable, but I have to ask the question, when it comes to the fact that Della Porta was world champion, I ask you, was it so much that Della Porta won the championship, or was it that Aaron Canet lost the championship?
It's a great question. Both great racers, although, you look at what Canet did towards the end of the season, crashing out, four or five races.
He couldn't qualify well there for a while either.
Couldn't qualify well. To me, I think Canet lost it, my opinion.
You okay, so you're in the camp that that De La Porta didn't win it, Canet lost it.
Canet lost it.
Okay. All right. I'm all in the opposite camp. I think that De La Porta won it, and I think that De La Porta's consistency two things. One, De La Porta's consistency there that he tried to turn on towards the end of the season, where he was, it was every race, he was there at the podium. Maybe not winning races, but he was there on the podium. And the fact that the KTM was definitely not the bike it was last year. Honda stepped up their game.
Good point.
And so that put pressure on Canet, who potentially was trying different setups that didn't suit him that well. Especially when he was qualifying bad, I think they were chasing a setup, trying to find something that maybe would allow him to either square off the corner a little more to get onto the gas earlier, or maybe they were trying to look for a little more braking stability so he could go deeper into the turns. But that was a result of his motorcycle not being as good as De La Porta's, and therefore him trying to ride above what he truly was capable of riding at, and was in a zone where he couldn't do it. And therefore you crash because you're riding at a level that's beyond the capability of the motorcycle you have underneath of you. Now, if you can say what you want, but if Canet was riding a Honda as well as De La Porta was riding a Honda, I think that race, that championship would go down to the wire. But I think De La Porta rode more mistake-free than Canet has. And I think that was shown out throughout the course of the season.
Yep, that's completely true. I think that's, you sewed that up pretty well. And I think because it's more of a hit or miss with Canet, and
yeah,
fortunately, you can only hit blackjack number six or number seven once in a while, and no question, De La Porta was much more consistent.
Yeah, and consistency wins championships. That's the hallmark of what a champion does. You go in and you say, okay, this is the best that I have right now. I'm going to race as hard as I can on Sunday, and I'm going to take as many points as I can through that. Now, I will admit De La Porta was lucky, because there was that round where Canet was knocked down, and it was no fault of Canet's. He was in the wrong place at the wrong time, and that's racing luck. But that was only one instance versus some of the other instances, which I believe were truly Canet's fault. I mean, like Phillip Island, Canet was riding so deep into the first turn there on the brakes, and he just lost the front. He was down, he went, because he was just trying to carry so much more corner speed because his KTM didn't have the top end that the Hondas did. So, it panned out like we figured it would pan out. It was definitely Canet was there. I thought Canet was going to win the championship. He was so close the year before. Yet De La Porta stepped up his game, and he went to it and did it. And, he had that little bit of a lull where things weren't working for him, and we find out in Buriram in Thailand that, his grandmother had died. You could tell he was emotionally distraught over that, and that he really cared. I'm sure his grandma loved him. I know he loved his grandma. And that's hard, because you've got to learn to separate an emotion out of your racing. And I think he realized it. I think it helped him. I think that moment kind of galvanized De La Porta, where he realized he was racing for something more. He was kind of racing for that championship. He was racing for it for his grandma. He wanted to do it for her, because she probably had supported him forever, right? And sometimes you need that. It's that weird motivational thing you see sometimes, like in Olympics and stuff. They're, my mother has cancer, so I was able to win this and I dedicate it to her. And you have that extra bit that you need to push on. It was a long season, and maybe that was just that little bit more that De La Porta needed. I don't know.
Well, but you hit the nail on the head with the consistency part. It gets back to that whole story.
It's always down to consistency. Always down to consistency. Let's talk about the manufacturing battle in there. I think we kind of got through the first part there. Honda versus KTM. KTM came out last, not in 2019, but 2018, made some upgrades at Le Mans, new airbox, new exhaust, and those KTMs were a rocket ship in acceleration and top speed that was superior to what Honda had. Honda said somewhere late 2018, we're coming with a whole new bike and we're coming for you, and they made good on their promise. I think they had the better bike. They had far more top end. They had far more speed, and they had much better acceleration than the KTM did. I am shocked that KTM did not come up with an upgrade for their riders.
How so?
Well, KTM is a big company. They're a big corporation. Like, Honda's a big corporation. They have Red Bull money behind them. But they didn't. You didn't hear how Canet got a new airbox or a new exhaust, or they had new electronics or whatever you could do to the bike. There weren't. They seemed like KTM just didn't give anybody an upgrade, and I wonder, was KTM stretched a little thin in hindsight with all the problems they have with their Moto 2 chassis, that they were working sort of around the clock to solve that problem, and they didn't have enough engineer people, dyno time, whatever you want to say, to develop that bike. And I wonder if that's a bit of why KTM is rebranding that bike as a Husqvarna for next year. Does that give them a little more freedom, so to speak? Are they going to be able to leverage the Husqvarna engineers? I get it. They're pretty much the same motors, and it's really, you taking the orange paint off of it and you're putting white paint on. But is it a financial thing? Hey, now this R&D cost is a Husqvarna cost. It's not a KTM cost. You know, you get numbers. I mean, you think I'm going down the wrong road with that one, or do you see that's potential?
No, I think that's a great way to look at it. And I think it's a business, and you got to run the numbers and kind of go with your return on your investment. I mean, what results are you getting, and what does it cost to get there? And I think that's a good way to look at it. I think it's a good business acumen. It's good. It keeps things focused on what's important, building a strong bike, but also doing it in a cost-effective manner within the realms of that particular manufacturer.
Agreed. So I think that's Moto 3, unless you've got something else you want to throw in there somewhere.
Nah, you wrapped it up well. Excellent.
So let's go to Moto 2. Let's get this out of here. This was Triumph's first year supplying motors to the class. I thought Triumph presented themselves well. I cannot think of a motor problem that they had per se. There were some clunky gearbox things that kind of showed up a little bit here and there, a niggle, but nothing that was championship impacting. So I think Triumph did a really good job. I thought that motor just sounded awesome when we were at COTA. I love the sound that thing makes. And I thought having a few more CCs and a little bit more torque really kind of changed the dynamic of how the grid shook out. And it was interesting, too, in there that how Kalex seemed to get that chassis right. And so did Speed Up. But KTM just lost it. They, you know, Bender talked about the whole time how they had chatter, and the chatter was coming from the back and it would work its way to the front. And they had, I think, 6 or 7 different revisions of that bike over the course of the year. I don't I don't get where KTM lost the plot on that one, because Kalex was in the same boat, right? It's either KTM didn't do a whole lot of thinking they were going to get there, but they put, here's the other strange thing for KTM on this one for me. They put so much effort into making that motorcycle better for Bender, and then they said, well, we're done as a supplier of frames for Moto 2.
Good point.
What's their thinking in that one? You guys are all talking about it's KTM, we're ready to race, this is what we do, we race, and you're not racing now. And you had a very linear path that you could come into the factory team, you can be on a Moto 3 bike, and then you can graduate from that to a Moto 2 bike that is a factory framed KTM, ride there, and then you can progress directly onto a Moto GP bike, as Brad Binder has done. He's gone up that ladder, and now you don't have that ladder anymore. And I'm going, that doesn't seem to make a whole lot of sense to me, but you know, I think it's a numbers game. Just, it's a money deal. It's a resource money thing, I think.
Well, and who knows where that's going to lead them to. You know, you got the four or five chassis now in MotoGP to Moto 2.
You're only going to have Speed Up and KLX next year.
KLX.
Yeah. So that's as far, unless somebody else decides to come in that I'm not. Oh, yeah. Yeah. Those are the only ones that are there.
NTS.
Yeah, that's it. There's ATS. That's the Japanese one. That's the other one that's there. So, yeah, I mean, but really it's predominantly KLX and Speed Up, right? And there's only really two Speed Ups that are out there, and they look pretty good at times. So remains to be seen sort of what happens. And, you know, the question is for people like Jorge Martin, what is he going to have? Is he going to have a KLX? Is he going to have maybe a Speed Up? We're not sure. Maybe, you know, that team's, no, I suppose the factory team, but Guy Coulomb and the guys over at Tech 3 may wheel the old Mistral chassis back out and throw a Triumph engine in it. Who knows? But one of the other things I wanted to talk about in Moto 2 was, again, you had a tire change in the midpoint of the season. Well, not the midpoint, but the beginning of the season. So we were running on a narrow Dunlap tire for the opening flyaway races. You did Qatar, you did Argentina, and you did Coda all on a narrow tire. Then you went to Jerez, and they came out with the wider, little lower profile Dunlap rear slick. And that point changed the entire dynamic. Baldessari had the championship at the beginning of the year. He looked fantastic. He was riding well. But somehow you put the bigger tire on the back of his motorcycle, and it just didn't work at all. But the person who it did seem to like magic was like magic sauce was Alex Marquez. Poof, he instantly was just faster based on that. And it's like, is that more of the dirt track thing that he does? Not sure, yeah. But it did make it crazy that he was in that position. And so I beg the question to you, was Alex Marquez that good this year, or was he that lucky this year to take the title?
That's a great question. You know, the last 5, 7, 8 years or whatever the case may be, looking at the bikes and having understanding that the tires can be the difference maker. We've seen it where the racer wears their tires down towards the end of the race and then they get caught by somebody behind and vice versa. But the power of the bike, the power of the tire, put that together, it's a winning combination. You could probably say that he was very fortunate for sure. Timely. He's talented. Yeah. He was also consistent. So it's tough to say.
Yeah. I'm not sure on this one. I mean, if I look at it, yeah, the first three races of the year, Marquez, Alex, that is, struggled, I think, a little bit. He found something with the bigger Dunlap slick, And he went on a bit of a tear. He won some races. He had a three-peat there, was looking for a four-peat at one point in the season. He really only made a mistake, and that was at Silverstone. But meanwhile, Binder was riding his ass off on the Triumph KTM with different chassis, was winning at Assen, or was on the podium at Assen maybe, or won, went to Sachsenring and won, stayed with that chassis. And in the second half of the season, nobody scored more points than Binder did. He outscored Marquez in the second half of that season. So, you know, I got to think, if KTM had their sums right at the beginning and had a bike that was just that little bit better at the beginning of the year, Binder could have been champion. And look, I think Binder got into Alex's head at the end of the year, right? Essentially, I think pretty much after he was in his own head after Silverstone crash, because he just lost the front, out front, lost the front, and was done. And after that, he started to think about, oh, I have a lead in this championship. Then he started riding conservative. And if you're not riding fast, you're not riding at the edge, you're not riding where you're used to riding. So that creates a whole other set of problems and dynamics. And he really never got his act back together again until his brother told him, just, you got to go race. I mean, he did what he had to do to win a championship. But I still think Binder was the better rider. I just do. And in all honesty, I'd like to see Binder on the Honda and not at the KTM, but I'm still fascinated to see Binder riding in MotoGP.
Yeah, he's a talent. No question about it.
He just grabs that whole thing by the scruff of the neck and just sort of races it. And he, you know, I was reading in Matt Oxley's article that he wrote for Motorsport Magazine about Binder, and Binder said, well, I think it's my job just to race what they give me and try to help them make it better, but my focus is worrying about what I have and racing on what I have and make it as best as I can for me. And that sounds a lot like what Zarco was doing on the Yamahas when he was got the satellite bike and he was looking really good there for a while, and then you thought Zarco would have taken that same idea over to KTM, but it just didn't work. But I think it's going to work this time with Binder, because Binder has no preconceived idea of what a MotoGP bike should be like. I'll sum it up this way. Alex deserved it because he was more consistent than Binder was. Binder had an excuse card, which you can't play because that's just racing. But Alex did finally do what a lot of people thought he could do, you know. This is a kid, he's now a two-time world champion. He won a Moto3 title, and he's now won a Moto2 title. You can't take either of those two championships away from him. So he's definitely got some talent, and I think he, in the end, deserved the Moto2 championship.
Well, it's going to be interesting for sure. 2020 is going to be an incredible year. Exciting stuff.
That's right. Anything else for Moto2 before we talk about the big guys?
One quick little point. What do you think about, and this is just a kind of a off-the-cuff question, so to speak, how much do you think Danny Petros has helped Binder over just from his development?
I don't think Pedrosa has actually helped Binder at all. I think he's helped Espargaro, LA, or Pole, with the MotoGP bike, because, you know, as Danny has started to get onto that bike, they started taking frame bolts out and all that good stuff. I think to get, you know, get some flex and whatnot in the bike. I think that it's going to be very, very interesting to see what Pole and Brad Binder can do on that bike with Pedrosa supporting them in the background for development. And I mean, we can get more into that in MotoGP, but that's what I think.
Yeah, good point.
All right, so MotoGP. I think the first thing that comes to mind when you think of MotoGP this year was the utter domination of Marc Marquez. Would you not agree?
That's unreal. Absolutely unreal.
The scary thing, I think, for me if I'm a competitor against Mark Marquez, is now we've gotten insane consistency with someone who is honing his racecraft. And that is a very deadly combination. It's been said before, I think all these accolades are justified, but Marquez is an amazing talent who was first or second in every race except COTA, where he crashed out. That's even more than Doohan's domination back at the end of the two strokes era of GP. I am utterly amazed at it. And if you think that it's all the motorcycle, I will say there's no way, because Cal Crutchlow and Nakagami are both riding that motorcycle, same motorcycle, and they cannot do on that motorcycle what Mark Marquez can do on that motorcycle.
I totally agree. I totally agree with you.
And the thing is, for me, is can Alex even remotely do something as close with that motorcycle, right? Because if you can split the difference somewhere in there, right? Crutchlow on his day is incredibly fast. He's will win you a race if kind of everything sort of lines up for him. But if it's not working well, Crutchlow's either on the ground or he's mired back in that 7, 8, 9, 10 place. And, you know, Nakagami is sort of in the same boat. He's sort of in that 7, 8, 9, 10 area. Can Alex bridge that gap that Honda's been wanting, that there's another HRC bike on the podium or there's another HRC bike in that 3, 4, 5, 6 spot? Remains to be seen, but we just don't know. So that was the first takeaway I've got for MotoGP. The second takeaway I have is it was the year of the rookie. Fabio Quartararo, I think, almost stole the show from Marc Marquez in his riding. Just, he came out, he started on poles and was, you know, like came out of the blue, and he was just racing the wheels off that Yamaha. I mean, if you watch some of those pole laps and front row laps that he would throw in the dying seconds of a qualifying session, that boy was way beyond the limits of anything. It was phenomenal to watch. And you kind of saw him take, at the latter part of the year, you saw him take that racing and that effort, and you saw him taking it to Marc Marquez. And, you know, whether we want to believe it or not, when you got to like Thailand, Marquez did not have to win that race in Thailand at all. There was no way. He didn't have to do that because he was going to win the world championship regardless. Dovizioso had fallen off like the face of the earth, basically, right?
Yeah.
And here he was, yet he still sat behind Quartararo lap after lap after lap after lap after lap, sized him up, tested the waters here and there, and then slammed into that last part of the race, or the last turn, with a phenomenal pass to win the title. I mean, you know it hurt Quartararo, and you got to believe that is the beginning of the psychological warfare that we are going to see played out between these two. I contest Marc Marquez is a smiling assassin. Would you not? Do you not agree? Well, I mean, he sits in the pit box and he's just smiling, happy-go-lucky, but he is going to win. He is driven to win, and that's all he wants to do. And I think he's like some people, he's, you know, physically sick if he doesn't win. I think losing hurts that bad. But he's begun to learn that if he cannot get a first place, a second place is just as good in the championship hunt. And I don't know. Do you think Quartararo will have the consistency next year to challenge Marquez for a title?
I do. I really do. I think
over the long run, he's going to be there week in, week out.
Yeah, you know, it depends. To be honest, I think ultimately you got to have a good bike too. Now, is the Yamaha going to be as strong or stronger than they were yet last year relative to the Hondas and Ducatis?
They
The
seem to be going the
straightaways,
right way.
and they seem to be going the right way. And Fabio did a lot of great stuff on a bike that was challenged last year. So obviously, he wore out the tires towards the end of a couple of the races, but he was right there with Mark on a number of those races.
So let's talk about Yamaha. Yamaha has been struggling with the standardized electronics, with the magnetic Morelli system. They've had, there's been a lot of talk about whether they had too much crank weight or too little crank weight in there, sort of like Suzuki had with their inline four. We really didn't see any real progress out of Rossi or Vinales until Quartararo comprehensively started kicking their ass. And even more, Bedelli was there beating the factory bikes, okay? So was the more Bedelli Quartararo combination, was it one of those things where the factory team finally went and said, I think we got a problem here. We need you or no, that's not a great way to say it, but do you think that the efforts of Morbidelli and Quartararo on the Sprinter Petronas team lit a fire under Rossi and Maverick Vinales?
Absolutely.
In what way?
Well, I think it caught him off guard a little bit, to be honest with you. I don't think that they expected him to be as strong as he was. And ultimately, you got a 20-year-old who's, for example, was hoping what I think what his what was his target for the year? 50 points, and he blew through that like. And I mean, so I really think part of it is you see Vinales and Rossi, two great riders themselves, and they're looking over their shoulder and seeing this young cat just fly right by them, so to speak. And I think it caught him completely off guard.
Yeah, I agree with you with that. I think they were taken aback at how willing Quartararo was to ride over the edge. I mean, Quartararo has kind of mimicked the Marc Marquez idea of racing, that there is another ledge out beyond the edge that you can ride at. And that's where Quartararo is. Now, make no mistake, Yamaha themselves have made tremendous progression on their bike. And it's in case it has been that way with Vinales. The last few races of the year, Vinales was riding really well, but he had that weird problem. Remember how he would qualify decent, he would start well, and then he would lose 3, 4 tenths a lap for 3 or 4 laps and be winding up a second or two behind, and then he would come on strong towards the end. And Yamaha has to work to level that out now. And I ask you this question: who's now driving the bus at Yamaha as far as development? Is Yamaha listening to are they listening to Vinales and Quartararo and what they want from a motorcycle? Or are they listening to Rossi and what Rossi wants from a motorcycle?
You know, my personal opinion, I think you look at the personalities there, and I think my opinion is they're saying they're listening to Rossi and Vinales. But I got to tell you, in my opinion, I think that you'd be foolish not to also have your ears looking out at Quartararo, this 20-year-old brilliant rider who could who's challenging Mark in a year that really Mark is not being challenged at all. So it's a it, politically maybe they're saying Rossi and Vinales is maybe Rossi first, Vinales second, but that's where you start asking the question, where's Yamaha going in the next 3 to 5 years? Will Rossi even be around in a year or two? Should they even be in should they develop a bike for someone who won't be there to use it for all intents and purposes?
Well, one more thing about Quartararo. We know that he gets a full-on factory motorcycle next year. He gets an exact copy of what Rossi and Vinales are going to get. Petronas has upped their money to get him that motorcycle. And we also know that, oh, good grief, I lose this every time. Who's the guy who's the head of Yamaha Racing? I got his face, but I can't come up with his name. You know who it is. Oh, gosh. Everybody's yelling at me right now because I can't think of it. Lynn Jarvis. Thank you. Lynn Jarvis wants Quattraro's name on a long contract, but Quattraro's manager is playing this one smart. Hey, look, every race that we run and we don't sign a contract, because we have a two-year contract with Sprinta Petronas, we can wait till next year and we can see, hey, is he going to win a race? Because Quattraro was so close to actually having a race victory, which would have been phenomenal. I mean, look, and this is sort of an amazing statistic when you think about it. The youngest pole sitter, the youngest race winner, and the youngest world champion was Freddie Spencer until Mark Marquez showed up on the scene and took every one of those away from Freddie. Now, the youngest ever pole sitter has been eclipsed. It's been taken away from Mark Marquez, and it's been given to Quattraro. This kid's a talent. He's a serious talent, and he needs to be on a very good motorcycle. I think Yamaha is trending the right way. They've finally poached a software engineer from Ducati who knows and understands the Bagnetti Morelli system, and I think they're going to finally turn this around. And I would very much love to see a Honda and a Yamaha and a Ducati battling each other week in, week out for those podium positions. I think it'd be great. But you brought up an interesting thing. It's like Rossi. Let's talk about the Rossi thing here. You said, is Rossi going to ride 2, 3, 4 years more? Who knows? I don't know. But I have to ask you this question. There was a time when MotoGP needed Valentino Rossi. I'm not so sure that MotoGP needs Rossi anymore. I think Rossi needs MotoGP more. Agree? Disagree?
You know, I would say in the last year, 2 years, it's been a challenge, a struggle for me when I look at where Rossi's at. And I would agree. I flat out would say agree today. No question about it.
So you think Rossi, that MotoGP doesn't need Rossi as much as Rossi needs MotoGP?
Correct. Okay. I view Rossi today, and don't get me wrong, Rossi is, no question about it, iconic. He's done a lot of great things. But as we all get older and the next generation moves in and they're faster and stronger, there's a point where racers know that they're not going to get the result that they want. And so, you know, I read an article, for example, recently that Rossi was quoted as saying he's targeting a top three finish in 2020. And I don't think I've ever heard him say anything like that. It's championship or not. So maybe his days are numbered sooner than we think. I believe at this particular stage that Rossi, he's got a lot still to offer. There's no question he's still one of the greatest on the planet. And if the Yamaha had better straight line speed, like the Hondas and the Ducatis, maybe there'd be more to it than that. But I just think that he's, at the end of the day, I think he needs MotoGP more than MotoGP needs him.
Fair enough. Do you think Rossi has an exit strategy planned out?
Yeah, I do.
What is it?
I do. VR46, no question, is in there.
So, in what way?
I think, you know, from my perspective, I think he will be training the next great racers. I think that will be one of his gems, if you will, his goals. But I also think, I don't think his racing career is completely over. I could see him in a four-wheel machine as opposed to a motorcycle.
Well, he's been rallying. We know that. So you think he goes that way?
I think it's possible. You know, you hear him and Lewis Hamilton get together and talk about racing, using one getting on the motorcycle, one getting on to the F1 machine. And I don't think it goes that far, but maybe it becomes a little more of a week-to-week commitment as opposed to...
See, I think Rossi's exit strategy is he creates his own VR46 MotoGP team. Yamaha gives him some bikes. He races out however long he wants to race on that with the support of the factory, but his factory, you know, he's not going to be on a monster Yamaha. I think he's going to be on a VR46 Yamaha.
So you're thinking that he'll still get the same, he'll have the same factory bike, just a different.
Yeah.
A different.
I think he has to. I think that way it kind of lets him slide into the managerial sunset of training the new coming riders. I mean, look, when Morbidelli, he was the first person to go through the VR46 Academy to win a world title. Look at the face. Look what Rossi's face was. Rossi looked like a proud papa.
He did.
So, I mean, I think that's where he's going to move towards. Now, whether he does it with the VR46 team or he just says, no, folks, I'm done, that's up to Rossi. But I do think that at this point, Rossi is plotting an exit strategy of some kind.
So what you're saying is you think he might be having a career change. He's not going to be no longer the doctor, but the teacher.
Maybe, who knows? Let's talk about Ducati. I want to talk about Ducati now. What happened? Dovizioso had those great years, right? He was the only person who could really challenge Marquez. And suddenly this year, Dovizioso, what can I say? They became an also-ran? That sort of would be my take on it. At least I think it would be. I'm not sure why. That's the part that I just don't get is the why. And I thought the other interesting fact with Ducati was that Dovizioso became very vocal later on in the year that it's the same problems we've always had. I just can't turn the motorcycle. So it begs the question, does Ducati need to, do they need to blow it up? Do they need to come up with a whole new chassis designed by DG DeLina? Does DG DeLina need to stop playing with cool aero tricks and all kinds of little funky hole shot devices and all this other stuff and go back to what made the Aprilias good or not? And I'm not sure, but you got to wonder, Ducati has the oldest group of riders riding for them between Petrucci and Dovizioso. And you look at it, who are the riders that are fast now? It's the young kids. It's the Quattraros, the Morbidellis, Mark, Alex, maybe, and maybe Bender or Pol coming on, right?
Alex Rins, maybe. Hey,
Alex Rins there. Yeah, we haven't gotten to Suzuki yet, but is there, I want to see Ducati come back. I mean, I want them to win at other places other than Mugello and Austria, but they just can't seem to do it. And I wonder, if maybe DG DeLina thought, hey, look, we were really close to the title last year. Marquez barely beat us, if you will. And if we just improve incrementally again, we're going to be okay. I think they were caught off guard by the power that the Honda had, because the Ducatis were not pulling away from the Honda like they used to be. That is a for sure statement. So maybe that's got a bit to play in it. I'm not sure.
Well, what do you think about this? If they were still on Michelins and not
still on Bridgestones?
Bridgestones.
Instead of Michelins? Okay.
Instead of Michelins.
Okay.
Would that have changed the outcome, do you think?
And the outcome this year?
Yeah.
That's a really interesting question. Because, I mean, you've moved too many years beyond Bridgestone tires. So now all the chassis and all the frames have started to be softened or fundamentally designed now around the Michelin front, which has nowhere near the amount of grip and feel that the Bridgestone had. So if they had Bridgestone tires this year with those frames, I don't think it would change the difference, because if you give Marc Marquez any more front end grip, I mean, he's not winning by 10 seconds, people. He's winning by a lap. So no, I don't think so. I think that of all of the bikes, I think the Ducati has suffered more with the change to Michelin than anyone else. Honda's probably suffered the second most with the change to Michelin. However, when you have someone like Marc Marquez who has this instinctual feel of how the rubber springs back and forms back into a round cylinder again, and that contact patch that it has, and innately can understand that there's only this much more grip left to give just this ounce of throttle, this ounce of brake more before it collapses on itself, I think is one of the main reasons that Honda's there. I think the Ducati was an easier bike to turn when it was on a Bridgestone because there was more feel for Dovizioso, and he was able to essentially light the back end up and turn the corner because there's not as much traction at the back of the bike with a Bridgestone tire as there is with a Michelin tire. You know, how many times did we see in the Bridgestone era, you saw Dovizioso, Marquez, whoever, everyone on the front end and the back tires off the ground by, what, 3-4 inches? That's and incredible. half the time Marquez had the whole bike sideways on the front tire. And we don't see that anymore. That's gone because there's not the feel, there's not the grip for the front Michelin, but all the grip is now on the rear Michelin. So now everybody has to figure out how to keep the back end on the ground so that we can use that back tire to slow us down going into the corner. And you know, I thought about this, and it could be conspiratorial, but I honestly think that Michelin could build a tire, or they should be able to build a tire to the equivalency of what Bridgestone built for a front. It isn't like they don't have the resources, the engineering, or the technology to be able to do it. My question is, has MotoGP politely asked, can you not give us as much front grip so that thereby we have to use more rear grip? We technically are lengthening the braking zone going into a corner, so you can get a little better racing and close the pack up a little bit because the limitation is that front grip and how much braking you can do through your front end while turning. Where before, you almost had an unlimited amount of grip and ability to turn. So I don't know. It's interesting. It's a great question, but I just don't think it would have mattered. They could have, and I think the result would still be the same. Long answer, short, too late.
No, you know, interesting dynamic.
Incredible. It is. It's incredible dynamic. Alex Rins broke through this year. He had a win at COTA. Granted, Marquez did fall off in front of him, but you got to finish first. To finish first, you must finish. And Rins did. The Suzuki was so good at the beginning of the year, but Suzuki is the smallest of all the manufacturers. They don't have the resources to maybe develop as much. And at the end of the year, Alex Rins was struggling with that motorcycle. We saw Alex Rins not qualifying in the top 10 and being in the Q2 session. He was trying to come through. He was trying to come through at Aragon. They tried and gambled on a hard tire to get through because the Suzuki was not able to run on the softs, something that Rins had been able to do throughout most of the season. So somewhere Suzuki lost the plot. And I, you know, looking at how Rins would race, I mean, he beat Marquez heads up at Silverstone. So obviously he's got talent. So, and he backed up his COTA win, right? He backed up, hey, this is a win that I had. And people may have scoffed and said, well, you know, Marquez did fall off. Well, no, he beat Marquez at a track that Marquez does somewhat struggle at. I'll give you that, because you got the big fast flowing circuits, which is a lot of time on the edge of the tire there, sort of at Silverstone. And Marquez couldn't really do anything with him. He got pipped by thousandths or a couple thousandths of a second. It was impressive. But from like that point on, it just like it went downhill for him. And I don't really understand why. I don't know if Suzuki knows why. Their engine was good. They could maybe need a skosh more horsepower out of it, but that's something that's going to have to come incrementally because they can't make a huge change to it because they're going to lose the finesse and handling that they have, which is a strength. But you know, somehow they've lost either electronic traction control or something. And I'd love to know what Rins thought about the last part of that season, because something doesn't add up, because you just don't usually lose yourself like that. I mean, they had a good base setting and then suddenly they didn't. So I don't know if Suzuki threw some parts at it to try to help him maintain or maybe perhaps catch Dovizioso in the championship or whatever. But that's an interesting case.
Well, you know, I'll tell you, the new engine too at Suzuki will be interesting to watch. It sounds from...
They need horsepower.
Yeah, and it sounds like from what we're hearing is Rins and Mir are at least giving the thumbs up, so to speak, to this new Suzuki engine, although it's too early to say. You know,
that's why we test.
That's right. So...
I think the people that I really want to watch in testing, I really want to watch where Suzuki is. I really want to watch where Ducati is. I think Yamaha is definitely going to be near the top of the timesheets. You know Honda's going to be there. But those two manufacturers, I really want to watch. So anything else you want to say about Suzuki? Because I want to get to KTM here and wrap this up.
No.
All right, KTM. So KTM, they had at the end of 18, they had a pole. They had the podium with Paul Espargaró in the rain at Valencia. My question to you is, did KTM carry that momentum that they gained from that podium into this season?
I hope so.
Did they? I'm saying, did they take? Not I hope so. There should be a real answer to this. It should be yes, they did, or no, they didn't, because we're talking about 2018's podium and then how the bike worked in 2019.
I do. I think they did, and I'm gonna reach out. I'm just gonna reach out there and say yes. I'm excited just to see Bender.
Yeah,
and
me
Paul
too.
Race. I can't wait to see what he can do on the MotoGP bike, and I think the KTM bike's improved. But I just looking forward to it. An exciting year.
Yep.
For those guys.
I'm hoping that it's another season that KTM will build on. I think having Bender in the group, or in the team, sorry, with Paul Espargaró is going to be phenomenal. I think it's the best thing KTM has done. And I say that because Bender's style and Paul's style are so complementary to each other, how they ride the motorcycle. They're super aggressive, super deep on the brakes, and they make it all happen. And I think that KTM did carry a lot of that momentum that they got from that podium in 2018. Because look, how many times was Paul already in Q1? Or sorry, sure. In Q2. He made it to Q2 quite a lot. There wasn't a lot of times that he was having to come out of a Q1 session there. I mean, yeah, a little bit. But more often than not, KTM was a top 10 motorcycle for qualifying. And, you know, if anybody watched Paul's massive slide through, what is that, turn 11 in Valencia up over the hill, the left-hander to end the lap was just sideways, rubber smoking. I mean, he was riding without traction control because it had turned off somehow. So he's definitely got the bit between his teeth in that respect. So I'm completely jazzed on KTM for next year. I really hope that we can go get a little bit more. I want to see where Bender goes with that bike. And I think he's measured. I think he knows he just wants to get on the bike, have measured improvement time after time after time. You know, a little faster this session, a little faster, a little faster, a little faster, and see where the cards lie. But I think it's a strong lineup out there. Well, that's what I see. So
it's exciting.
Would you bet on anybody else other than Mark Marquez winning the title next year?
If I was putting the money down on the table, I'd say no. No question in my mind.
I'd like to see the bookies' odds for Quartararo, because I'd be wanting to throw, you know, 100 quid on that one, right? Just because, I mean, you never know.
I think Quartararo is there. I think it'll be interesting to see. You know, we haven't talked a lot about Vinales. I think
we did not.
And I think he's potentially right there. Rins, better Suzuki engine. Could he be there? Ducati with...
they got to find how to turn in the middle of the corner.
Got to find, exactly. And tire spin. And so there's so many good riders in 2020. It's absolutely incredible. But hands down, like him or not like him, Mark is MotoGP right now. And he's almost virtually, I hate to say this, almost virtually impossible to beat unless he beats himself.
Mm-hmm. You know what what's also interesting is when you look at the races, the Rossi fan club is the largest group of people who's there. There's yellow domination, right? But there's a lot of red. And the red seems to keep getting bigger and bigger. Even in fandom, Mark Marquez is slowly becoming greater than Rossi. Even with the fans, you know, just because, I mean, these saves are incredible, right? you got to look at it. Even he was what, over 65 degrees of lean in Australia and didn't crash.
It's incredible.
That's ridiculous. And we saw his brother have a couple of really amazing saves on his Moto 2 bike. So who knows? I think 2019 was absolutely incredible season. And I think that we are well set and primed for an absolutely barn burner just to watch Quartararo and Marquez go after each other. And I hope Yamaha gets the sums right to move Quartararo just that little bit closer to Marquez, because I might be a Marquez fan, but above all, I am a fan of great racing. And I just think 2020 is going to be amazing.
Well, if you were to sum it up, biggest surprise, looking back 12 months from now, what do you think the biggest surprise might be?
In 2020?
For 2020.
Biggest surprise of 2020.
Does Rossi finally give up?
No. I'm thinking it's like a dry podium for KTM. I think that's going to be the big surprise. I just think it's going to be, you know, it's going to be something like that. It's going to be, you know, that or, yeah, I mean, I think it's just something like that. I just think that they're due for a dry podium. And it might be an attrition thing where a couple guys go down and that gets them close, but it's going to be a podium for KTM. I think that will be the biggest surprise in the dry. They've had a wet podium. I think they're looking for a dry podium. That I'll go with that. Yourself, you asked the question, so you got to have an answer too.
I think part of me, I go into the season, I have this feeling that Yamaha is going to step up again this year. I do think there's going to be a breakthrough season, but I do think, I'd love to see Rossi challenge again. I know it's a last hurrah. A lot of the young cats are up front now. It'd be nice to see a Dovi or a Rossi right in the mix of the battle. Love to see it. So maybe the outlier there is, do we see one last big hurrah from the 9-time world champion?
Maybe. I don't know. But that's what we watch, right?
That's exactly. Like, it's GM, we can smell it already, right?
I'm aching for it. I'm waiting for testing. So, all right, folks. That's the show. Hope you enjoyed the review. Hope you enjoyed a little look inside of what we thought, how 2019 worked out. Remember, we have testing from Sepang, and that's the next time that we will be here giving you a podcast to listen to. It'll be me. I'll be back, hopefully, with Derek, and we'll be talking about what all happened in testing and how testing doesn't mean anything right now, but we're still going to go over it and analyze it and overanalyze it and make all kinds of crazy predictions, which that's the fun of it all. So again, everyone, I hope you all have a joyous new year and a great 2020. I think 2020 is going to be awesome. Ciao.